days ago, the first pictures from NASA's James Webb Telescope were released. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kenton. Since then, astronomers say they've already found the fractals of a phantom galaxy, the entrails of the birth of a star, and maybe even the oldest galaxy ever identified. With our new eye in space, we are approaching being able to witness the beginning of time itself. So what in the world will we see next? You can join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234, as we gaze into the stars this morning. Email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Kenneth Sembach, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, an astronomer and UW-Madison alum who helped manage the Hubble Space Telescope and now leads the group conducting science and flight operations for the James Webb Telescope. So what do you want to know about how he sees our vast universe? Kenneth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee. How are you today?
I am excited to speak with you because from every astronomer's reaction, I just want to get your reaction to the first data released from the James Webb Space Telescope. What was it like when you first saw some of those photos?
Well, when I first saw those, I just thought, wow, this is really something we haven't seen before. They are amazing, aren't they?
Well, you worked on the Hubble Telescope, so how can you turn around and look at the results of the James Webb Telescope and say, we've never seen these before? What's the difference?
Well, Webb gives us a different view of the universe than Hubble, so that doesn't take anything at all away from the magnificent images and data that Hubble's produced over the years and will continue to produce. It's just that we're looking at the universe in a different light with the James Webb Space Telescope.
And
it's infrared light.
Right. They're literally looking at it in a different light, and you're able to see what we, with our eyes, can't see. Is this the explosion of excitement from astronomers? With the big picture, Ken, what does this mean for space exploration?
What it really means is that our view of the universe is going to be changed forever, because now we have access to this infrared window that's allowing us to look in places in the universe where we haven't been able to see before. We can peer deeper into clouds where stars are forming. We can look further back in time into regions that are really beyond Hubble's reach.
Mm. So the James Webb Space Telescope took off from Earth, what was it, last December? Where is it now, and how far do you plan to send it?
Well, right. It was launched on December 25th, so that was Christmas morning of last year. And so that was a really wonderful day to see the telescope finally arrive in orbit around the Earth and then get pushed out all the way to about 1 million miles from the Earth to a point called a Lagrange point, which is a semi-stable point gravitationally on a line between the Sun, the Earth, and that point. So relative to the Sun and the Earth, the telescope always stays at approximately the same position. It actually orbits around that point, 1 million miles from Earth.
And is that where it will stay?
And that's where it stays, yeah.
Mm. Tell us a little bit, Ken, just taking pictures from outer space as opposed to taking pictures from a terrestrial telescope, what's the difference there?
Well, there are quite a few differences. In the case of Webb, one of the most important differences is that the infrared light that it is sensitive to doesn't actually reach the Earth's surface at a lot of those wavelengths. And so it gets absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. So getting above the Earth's atmosphere gives you a clearer view and the ability to actually analyze that light. Another important thing for all space telescopes is that being above the Earth's atmosphere, you don't get the interference or the shimmering that you get when you're looking at the universe from the ground. So we've all gone out at night, you know, in Madison and Wisconsin, obviously, you get these nice cold winter nights where the sky's crystal clear and it's quiet and still, and the stars just, they shine. But in the summer, they get a little bit, you know, they twinkle more. Mm-hmm. And that's turbulence and disturbance in the air. And that degrades the quality of the imaging. It blurs them out a little bit. So when you're above all of that, in space, you have the advantage of being able to see more clearly as well as at wavelengths that you can't see from the ground.
We're talking about space and telescopes with Kenneth Sembach, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute. And if you have questions about what we are beginning to see from the images of the James Webb Space Telescope, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. Tell us a little bit about this team. I'm curious about how many people it takes to put this state-of-the-art telescope together, get it into space, find a stable gravitational area a million miles away from Earth that it can hold and continue to return data to us. It just seems like it would take everybody that you have to get this done. How many teams? What's it look like to put this all together, and how do you organize it?
Well, over the years, the development team for Webb was very large and included thousands of people in the government, at NASA, in industry, at Northrop Grumman, Ball Aerospace, and elsewhere. Our operation right now, both the flight operations and the science operations, and by science operations, I mean everything from selecting the science program to planning the observations to calibrating the data, archiving it, disseminating that information to everybody. All of that takes several hundred people.
Mm. Now, how do you organize several hundred people in a way that has this sort of technology just hanging out in space and giving us data that we've never seen before?
Well, we organize them into smaller teams, and each of those teams has a particular responsibility. And all of those teams then collectively work together, which is one of the real joys of seeing a mission like this produce data of this quality. You know that those teams are working together well because the end result is so spectacular.
Absolutely. And is there any of the data that's come in so far that is struck you in a way that you did not expect yet, Ken?
I think all of it has at some level.
Why is that?
Well, we're seeing something new. No. And so you can have your preconceived idea of what it should look like. And quite frankly, we should have known it was going to be this good. But until you actually see it, it really doesn't hit home. And so when you see these images in the detail and with the clarity and the contrast that you do, you realize that this telescope is actually tuned up as well as it can be tuned, and that it's really operating at peak performance. And that's a special thing, because the peak performance is considerably better than the specifications for the telescope, which is, I think, kind of what we all had in mind when we were thinking about what these initial images would look like.
So the James Webb telescope has exceeded its own specifications?
It has, indeed, in many respects.
And so the data that came out 10 days ago, is that just the start? And what's the future hold for what we will learn from this James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST?
Yeah, so that data is just the start.
Mm.
And there is an entire year of observations planned right now. We did a peer review competition within the science community about a year and a half ago to select that program. As the institute director, I have the privilege of being the selecting official for that. So I got to see what everybody was proposing, and the peer review made those recommendations to me and I approved them. And so there's a lot of exciting science, and we're observing right now, and will be 24/7, 365 days a year for as long as the observatory is operational, which we hope to be 20 or maybe even more years.
Hmm. Kenneth Sembach is director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, worked on Hubble. He is working on the James Webb Space Telescope a million miles away, bringing us data that we've never seen before and an understanding of our place in the universe that perhaps many of us have never even considered. It's exciting every astronomer across the board, because we are delving into the great unknown. So what do you want to know about it? 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue our conversation with Ken Sembach. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Can the new James Webb Space Telescope survive the harsh environs of space? It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and since launching at the end of last year, the telescope's reportedly been hit by at least 19 little meteorites. And one of those has damaged one of the telescope's 18 gold-plated mirrors. And so far, these hurtling space rocks do not seem to have hurt the satellite's capabilities at all, but this is just in the first few months of its existence. Our guest this morning, Kenneth Sembach. He's director of the Space Telescope Science Institute. He helped manage the Hubble telescope and now leads the group that is overseeing science and flight operations for the James Webb Space Telescope. And Ken, I have to ask you, what are some of the challenges that you face, that your satellite faces in space?
Well, space is a harsh environment, and so there are lots of challenges. You just mentioned one, these micrometeorites that are out there. This is just space dust, basically, that fills the solar system, and occasionally one of these little particles hits either the mirrors on the front of the telescope or the sun shield on the back side of the telescope. We knew that was going to happen when the telescope was being designed, and there was a tolerance budget built into the performance of the observatory to account for that. Keeping the telescope cold is a paramount importance, and that's why it has a five-layer sun shield to protect it, the telescope from the Earth and sunlight that might be impinging on it otherwise. And that's important in order to detect the infrared light, which is essentially heat from that early universe and other places in the universe that we're looking. Just making sure that the electronics and the systems on the observatory are running at optimal performance. We monitor those regularly, constantly, effectively. We have a telemetry stream that comes down, and our engineers look at all of that to make sure that all the voltages and currents and everything else are right. And just basically maintaining that environment of the telescope and its working operations. It isn't a set it and forget it kind of an observatory. You do have to watch it. And any little deviations, we take a look at that, make sure we understand what that might mean, and if necessary, make some tweaks.
Ken, you talked about this a little bit earlier about how you get to choose, you know, some of the science projects that the Space Telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, will examine. How do you go about making the decisions about where to point the lenses for observation?
So, as I mentioned earlier, we select the science programs through competitive peer review and get about 1,200 proposals in this first cycle to do that, of which we selected about 200 or so. Once those proposals are selected, then our scheduling team gets to work of putting together a long-range plan for all of those observations. It's a big jigsaw puzzle. You point at one spot in the sky, and then you have to go to another one, and then another one. How do you do that in a way that's efficient so that we're spending most of our time observing the universe rather than slewing around the sky? Mm-hmm. How do you do that in a way that allows us to maintain that thermal environment that we need, and to not use too much fuel on board and so forth? And then as we work our way through that long range plan each week or so, we really narrow down on that plan and send the specific instructions up to the observatory on a regular basis to make sure that the observatory is actually doing what it needs to do. And that whole choreography is something that looks out a year or more in time, but also focuses down to the second at some level.
But you had to, Ken, at some point reject some of these proposals. About one-fifth of them seems to have been taken on, but I imagine some of them were left on the cutting room floor. You would like to have the time and space to research.
Right. So a lot of those very worthy and interesting proposals that came in couldn't be scheduled in this first cycle. And so many of those investigators will resubmit them the next opportunity.
Okay.
And maybe they'll be more successful the next time, or maybe they'll tweak them and decide based on what we see here in that first cycle of observations to change the approach a little bit. And so science is an iterative process. And when you're applying for telescope time on Webb or any observatory, this is kind of the standard. you try and try again sometimes.
Just, yeah, and we've heard that about terrestrial satellites as well. Are there any of these research projects off the top of your head that you could explain in simple terms to non-astronomers, Ken?
I think in general terms, the four pillars of science that this observatory was really designed to address is really well represented in that first cycle of observations. So understanding that early light in the universe, when do the first stars and galaxies form and what do they look like? Understanding how stars form. And so being able to peer into star forming regions where stars much younger than our sun are just beginning to form out of the gas and molecules that exist in those regions. So another one is galaxy evolution. Those first galaxies that evolve in the universe look very different than the ones that we have in our local universe today. And so how over 13 billion years do galaxies change? How do they change shape? How do they change composition? And so forth. And then the fourth pillar is other worlds. Are there other worlds out there around around stars, some like our sun, that might be similar to the planets that we see in our own solar system? So studying exoplanets is a big topic for this first cycle of observations.
Ken Stenbach, our guest, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, and still time for your questions at 1-800-642-1234. And you also worked on the Hubble Space Telescope for what, about 20 years, managing this Hubble Space Telescope? What's that up to these days, Ken?
Hubble is still chugging away, making discoveries every day. It's an amazing, amazing observatory, and it's been wonderful to be able to work on it for so long. But many of the things that you'll see observed with Webb have either been observed with Hubble before or will be observed with Hubble. And that goes back to the point that we were talking about earlier. You want to get a multi-wavelength view of the universe because light is information. And the more light that you can collect at different wavelengths, the more information that you have to understand what you're seeing.
It's weird to think of you almost as a historian, all astronomers as historians, because as you look through space, it is intrinsically linked with time. So you were looking back in time, and it seems as though this James Webb Space Telescope, Ken, could take us pretty much as close to the beginning of time as we may be able to reach with what the technology we have right now. And what does that mean to you as an astronomer?
To me, it means we get a more complete picture of what was happening when the universe was really young. And we have models, but we don't have the data yet to test those models. And so this telescope will give us a lot of that data, and we'll understand then whether the starting point that we base our understanding of the universe on is actually right. Did it actually evolve the way we thought it would evolve? And did we and our local universe actually arrive at its present state in a way that we can understand through those models?
Like any historian, you're not going to know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
I think that's well put, yes.
Ken, also mentioned before that you are alumni of UW-Madison's astronomy program. And how did your time in Wisconsin take you all the way to the James Webb Space Telescope and the director of the Space Telescope Science Institute today?
Well, I never had any idea at that time when I was in Madison that I would be in this position today. But I had a great 4 years in Madison. The astronomy department there is absolutely wonderful. I was introduced at that point to observations from space by my thesis advisor, Professor Blair Savage. And fell in love with the idea of being able to extract information from light, which is a technique called spectroscopy. And I love the quantitative aspect of it, but also the qualitative. What can you actually learn?
And forgive me for suggesting this, but it seems as though you still have an infinite number of questions that need to be answered somewhere out there, Ken.
I think we do, and I think there are more and more every day.
Yeah, just the astronomer's reaction to the pictures. I don't claim to understand them, but I do understand human reaction, and it is those who know who seem to be the most excited about what we've seen just at the outset. So what do you expect next? Ken, we've got about a minute left.
You're going to see a lot more beautiful images and data coming from this observatory in the coming weeks and months. I think the most important thing in some way is the awe that this telescope and Hubble, for that matter, inspire. And it gives us a sense of, you know, our place in the universe, and gives us a chance to really reflect on just why we're here and what we're doing and what else is possible when we work together.
Those big questions out there in big space. Ken, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You bet, Lee. Thanks for the opportunity.
Kenneth Sembach, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute. He helped the Hubble Telescope, manage the Hubble Telescope, leads the group now conducting science and flight operations for the James Webb Space Telescope. And we continue in space this hour with our conversation with the director of the UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. You don't need a satellite. You don't need a telescope. You just need to look into the skies. I'm Lee Rayburn. News is next on the Ideas Network. So what do you see when you look up into a clear night sky? What does it make you feel? It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And does it feel like forever? Does it make you dizzy? Does it make you wonder? Does it at the very least broaden your horizons? Well, our next guest is an astrophysicist who's traveled all the way to the end of the Earth's atmosphere in order to get a better view of what's beyond. What would you like to know about what she sees when she looks into our stars? Our guest, Jean Creighton, is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Jean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, and let's just begin with your reaction of the first images we've seen from the James Webb Space Telescope, just released just 10 days ago.
I am extremely relieved because there were so many things that could go wrong. So we were all keeping our fingers and toes ready, you know, all in a knot to make sure that it works just the way it's supposed to, and it does. So now we can wait for pictures of the really far and bright and the close and dim.
Far and bright and close and dim. What do you mean by that, Jean?
Thanks for taking the bait. So we are looking for the very big picture, and for that we rely on very bright objects like galaxies or clusters of galaxies that are at astronomical distances. But we're also interested in the really deep and intriguing question, are we alone? And for that, we need to look at things that are dim but relatively close, so that we're looking at other planets, what we call exoplanets.
Exoplanets that would be a certain distance from a certain star that would be ripe for carbon-based life forms?
We can't be picky, right? Maybe it's carbon-based.
Nitrogen?
Maybe silicon. Who knows?
Wow. And as I mentioned, Gene, you'd previously flown on the SOFIA Stratospheric Observatory. You spent 20 hours up there. And tell us what you saw from just about space.
The stratosphere was a magnificent experience in the sense that you see a really crisp, dark sky. This is high enough that you're up more over most of the Earth's atmosphere's vapor. So you get to see much more clearly. But I have to confess, Lee, the thing that really blew my mind that I didn't expect to see were northern lights. The northern lights were literally breathtaking.
So you go up to the upper reaches of our atmosphere to look into our stars, and the thing you find most beautiful is back down here into the atmosphere of Earth.
But isn't that so often the case?
Yes, yes. I just think there is a point to be made there. I just wish I could, I could verbalize it better. So, and then bring us back down to the ground. How does your experiences up in the stratosphere compare to what we experience at your planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, Gene?
Well, the planetarium offers the wonderful opportunity to turn off all the lights.
Yes.
So that light pollution that plagues us, that interrupts our connection with the universe, we take that away and we're able to see what the sky should look like. And I really do think that gives perspective, that gives that kind of connection to the big picture, which I think we all need more of.
Yeah. And so that big picture is just looking up into the sky sometimes and providing perhaps a broader horizon. We're talking about stargazing with Jean Creighton, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. In 2014, she was also selected by NASA to be an Airborne Astronomy Ambassador. And she shared the cosmos with some 150,000 members of the community. So I will ask you, Jean, if I wanted to get involved in all the mysteries that face us when we look up into the night sky, how would I even get started?
What a great question, Lee. There are lots of different ways. So the first thing I would suggest is what I see people do, and I'm a little envious. Take your cup of coffee, go to the lake or wherever you can see either an eastern horizon or a western horizon, and look at the sunrise and the sunset. I think the sunrise is a little more poetic and a little more uplifting. Mm-hmm. But just that, especially when we're on vacation and we have a little more time, that is beautiful and different every day. So that would be a starting point. The second point would be, literally, I know this sounds kind of silly, but it's true. Look up. Often city dwellers assume that there's nothing to see, but in fact, you can have the moon during the day or night. You can have really bright stars. So right now you can look for a reddish star that comes pretty high in the sky early in the evening called Arcturus. And can I tell you something about Arcturus?
Please do. This little red dot in the sky that we can find?
Yes, it's an alien star.
I'm sorry?
What? Yeah, I said alien in the sense that it didn't grow up in the Milky Way. We can measure speeds of stars. And if that star had been born in the Milky Way, whoo, it would have left a long time ago. So we think that star belonged to another little galaxy that came too close to the Milky Way. We grabbed, thanks to gravity, it's probably the whole galaxy. We ate it all up. And that's probably the only star you can see in the sky without a very strong telescope that did not grow up in the Milky Way.
Well, I remember being a kid and being shocked by having a pair of binoculars and actually, do I remember this right? Being able to see the rings of Saturn at some point on a clear night through binoculars?
Yeah. So that would be the next step. So after naked eye astronomy, which as I said, I don't think we do enough of.
Right.
You can take a pair of binoculars. And the nice thing about binoculars is that if the astronomy bug leaves you, there's bird watching. There's other things.
They'll come in handy eventually.
Yes. So you can look with a pair of binoculars that doesn't need any setup. You can look at the moon. You can see the rings of Saturn on a clear night. You can see the moons of Jupiter, right? And that connects you to some of the most revelationary observations we ever made because it told us, oh, there's something that goes around something that's not the Earth. And it forced us to accept the Earth can't be the center of everything.
And that was Jupiter's moons that eventually forced us to accept the science?
Yeah.
Which, again, with a simple pair of binoculars on a good clear night and you're looking in the right place can be found. Which brings me, Gene, to the advent of the space apps or the star apps that I've seen some people use to help identify what they're seeing in the night sky. And as the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, how do you find the usefulness of these star apps?
Well, the honest question is, I don't need them. That's, I know it sounds arrogant, but I don't use it. But I do know that people get great delight in being able to put their phone up, point it in a certain direction and say, yep, that's, you know, they don't have to wonder, they know. Having said that, I would say practice a bit because, you know, if you look just with your phone one night and you find 5-10 things, you're not going to be able to find them again necessarily in a couple nights. Practice. See if you can guess first, I should say, then use the cheat sheet. What is in fact that thing? If you are up after midnight, you can see three planets right now. and see if you can guess which are the planets and which are the stars. For some people, that's challenging, and I get it. But after you look at them for a few nights, then you start realizing that the quality of the light from a planet is a little different. It's a little more steady than the quality of the light of a star.
That's fascinating. But also, and just from my experiences of gazing into the night sky, start seeing things moving around up there and wondering, is that an alien planet? What am I seeing? But then I'm reminded, and this is from Space News, we have over 4,500 active satellites orbiting the planet. So looking up into the night sky, you're bound to find one or two up there. How visible are satellites when you look up at night?
They are quite visible. And in some cases, one of the, I think it's called the Iridium satellite, is depending on how the solar panels are pointing, it can look extremely bright. It can be the brightest thing in the sky, you know, after the moon. But that you need to know when it's coming. But any regular satellites, you can, you know, you're right. You're likely to see a couple anyway. And if you are lucky, you don't need extreme luck, but you can see about 5 shooting stars an hour, any night of the year. I'm not talking about, you know, the Pleiades.
Right. Perseid meteor showers are annuals, but you're saying on any given day, we can look up at a clear night sky, and if we're looking long enough, we'll find shooting stars up there?
Yep. And that happened to me the other day. In fact, I was looking up for, you know, I was looking to see, okay, so where is, you know, Arcturus? And I was paddling down the river, and I thought, There's a shooting star.
Arcturus, you said it's a little red dot right now in our night sky?
Yes. And let me give you a clue to find it.
Yes.
So you're looking for the Big Dipper, which is going to be in the northwest.
I can find that.
You know, at around 10. Mm-hmm. Most people can find the Big Dipper. Having said that, Arcturus is brighter than any of the stars of the Big Dipper. So you'll see Arcturus before you see the Dipper. The phrase that I'd like you to repeat mentally or physically, lovely listener, is arc to Arcturus.
Arc to Arcturus. Thank you.
And spy Spica.
Spy Spica.
Those are two stars that you get for free from the tail of the Dipper. The Arcturus, as I said, is really bright.
Yeah.
But if you keep going, you'll see a dimmer star that will be closer to the horizon, called Spica, which is the brightest star in the constellation of Virgo.
Spica, the brightest star in the constellation of Virgo, and you can see it just by looking up. Our guest, Gene Creighton, an astronomer and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. If you are a citizen astronomer, what do you see in the night sky, and what would you recommend we gaze at? And what does it make you think? Bigger picture, 1-800-642-1234. Perhaps we're not so small after all. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. For me, anyway, a big part of the beauty of our Northwoods has got to be its night sky. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. And away from the endless artificial light, you get to feel as much as you get to see the seemingly infinite depths of space. And at least for me, it can be overwhelming and enough to make you feel insignificantly small until, I suppose, you begin to consider that in all of that apparent infinity of space out there, here you are. You're live, and life, as far as we know it and as far as we've searched, remains the rarest thing we've found so far across our entire universe. And that realization can be quite significant and profound. Our guest, Gene Creighton, an astronomer, astrophysicist, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and we're inviting you to gaze into the stars and asking you what you see, what you think, and what you feel at 1-800-642-1234. And if you've got suggestions for citizen astronomers or an app that you use to help you understand what you're seeing in the night sky, join us, share with our audience this morning, and let us know. Gene, I wanted to ask you, and we started the hour with talking about the launch date set for the new rocket. rocket from NASA that is intended to return people to the moon, that three private companies now are competing to be the first to make it to Mars, that there is a new space race afoot, and as you've studied the celestial heavens, and what do you feel about our returned focus to space?
I'm thrilled that we're using again our ability to solve problems to get people back to the moon, which would be a necessary step to get to Mars. Now, I don't have illusions that a whole lot of people are going to get to go to Mars. My guess would be 5 or 6 in the next 25 years. That would be my guess. But we would have to solve so many problems to make that possible. I think it would really be a magnificent achievement.
Yeah, and isn't that part of the whole goal itself is to solve these problems and figure out where the next advancement in science will be? And aren't problems like these the ones that help us get there?
Yes, and indeed, they help us on Earth, too. I mean, lots of the things, the phones that we use now and we take for granted, were part of the Apollo legacy, right? Because for Apollo, we built satellites that are definitely required for your cell phone. And also, it was the space race that made us think, okay, these electronics can't be as big as a warehouse. They need to be getting small, light, and energy efficient. And that's how we've gotten now to nanotechnology.
And the phone that fits right in your pocket, which especially exactly. Remembering the old first mobile phones, which needed its own suitcase. Gene, we started this morning going to UW Oshkosh and talking about a National Science Foundation grant to study the gender discrepancy in the STEM fields. And I, just from your experience, what was it that led you to get a doctorate in astrophysicists? What was it that led you to become the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and share your love of astronomy with hundreds of thousands of others?
Well, great question. So I come from a line of mathematicians. Hmm. I grew up in Greece, so my dad, my granddad, my uncle, my first cousin are mathematicians. And I love math, to be sure. But I got the bug of astronomy when I was really young. So when I was 5, my mom says we were walking down the street. I looked up and I said, "Mommy, how are stars born?" And that's been kind of like a backbone of my career. That's been a question of great interest. So I went one day, I thought, oh, we're going to have the big argument with my dad, because for many years, I just assumed I was going to be a mathematician. And I went home and I said, "Okay, Daddy, I don't want to be a mathematician. I want to be a physicist." And I thought we were going to have this big argument. And Daddy said, "Oh, okay, that's great." It was so anticlimactically.
You're getting all brave and having this speech prepped out. And I want to study the stars. Go get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, go for it. Yeah, exactly. And then I was told by a career counselor, "Oh, no. You can't become an astronomer because your eyesight isn't good enough."
What?
And that was pretty devastating. So anyway, I kind of pivoted. I went into physics, which I probably, in fact, was a great background to have. And then I kind of pursued again my interest when I saw the first images of Voyager 2 when it passed by Neptune. And then it was like, "Oh, no, sign me up. Gotta do this." And one of my physics professors said, "You don't need perfect eyesight. They're blind astronomers." I mean, my eyesight isn't that bad, but, right. But I do need glasses. So that meant that I could kind of get back on track for pursuing the dream. And I wouldn't have guessed when I was 18 that I would be, you know, when I was in Athens, that I would be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, directing a planetarium. But I love what I do. I absolutely love the possibility of connecting with my community and sharing what I know about the universe and trying to make it not dumbed down. Like, I don't want people to feel talked down to, but mm-hmm. I want them to see, "Oh, right, this is so cool and exciting."
The contagiousness of curiosity. Let's go to Mark in New Berlin this morning, who joins us with Gene Creighton, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I got my first small telescope about 65 years ago.
Wow.
And I just enjoy looking at the sky, probably more with binoculars now than with my telescopes, but I do bring the telescopes up. Two favorite things I've got to look at, probably the nebulas, and the easiest one, at least for me to find, is the Orion Nebula. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful, even with a very small telescope. And the other thing is a naked eye observation you can make, which is the Orion Andromeda galaxy. And it's the farthest thing that a person can see without using binoculars or a telescope.
How do I see the Andromeda galaxy with my naked eye?
It's out there. It's a fuzzy area, very dark sky. It's a fuzzy area about the size of the full moon, the diameter of the full moon.
Yeah.
It's, you've got to know where to look. You look around.
Right.
I use a sky map to find it. I'm sorry.
No. I'm fascinated by it. And in 60 years, and you're still looking up at the stars, right, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Although I hate the mosquitoes here.
Well, that's the factor we have not considered yet. But, Gene, what about the Orion Nebula and the Andromeda Galaxy and the fact that you don't need telescopes to see these?
I just wanted to put a plug for the planetarium. That is one of the advantages of the planetarium. There are no mosquitoes.
There you go.
But getting back to Mark's point, the Orion Nebula is indeed a naked eye object. Orion is great in the wintertime. If you're going to see Orion now, you have to wake up very early before the sun rises. Pegasus for me is the way you'll find Andromeda.
Okay.
That will be visible later in the evening. So if you go to bed later than I do, you'll see Pegasus even at around one. Pegasus looks like a square, and off one of the points of the square, there's a long curvy V. If you imagine that the V has an opening right at the top, you go that same distance to the side and you'll see that blob fuzzy thing that Mark refers to. You do need a dark sky, mm-hmm. to be sure. You need keen eyesight. And frankly, a little pair of binoculars helps. But if you have really dark sky, you will be able to see an object that's so far away, the light you see is 2 million years old.
We're looking back 2 million years in time when we see that Andromeda galaxy with our own eyes.
Mm-hmm. And that's the farthest you can see without a pretty good telescope.
But it's 200 million years is how far back do you want to go?
2 million years should do the trick. Yeah.
It's been a fascinating conversation, Gene, and thank you for inviting us to gaze into the heavens this morning.
Thank you.
Gene Creighton's an astronomer, astrophysicist, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and inviting you to look up. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.